Accession number 8224, rule number 2.
Mr. O'Riordan, rule 2.
Yes.
How are you going to be supplied if you'd been put into the field?
People like me didn't really know that or think about it, but it was assumed that our commanding officer had some arrangements made. There was stories from Major Drought's experiences of the previous war in German East that we would be able to live off the country. But we couldn't live off that country. It was desert with thorn trees, the northern frontier province of Kenya.
So there was nothing there to pick up?
There was nothing.
What about water?
We had water bottles, which we carried on our persons, but we didn't have any water carts or other supplies. We'd have presumably have had to have found water holes where we would have done the necessary ablutions and filled up our water bottles again. All these matters were not for me even to think about. I had no responsibilities for anything like that. It was difficult enough to keep going riding a mule.
Did many people find it difficult and painful riding mules?
I think many of them found it much more painful than I did. I had ridden before. Some of them never had. And I think they found it difficult trying to force the mule to go the way they wanted it to go and the speed they wanted. We used to get new mules in from time to time, and some of the other ones were taken away, but you couldn't really tell when you went and tried to catch one of these mules in this throng and say, I'll try that one today. Eventually you found one which suited you, and you suited it, and there you were. I think we really, we the troopers, didn't really think too greatly about where we were going and how and who would bring us food and water. We were just doing this elementary basic training, really, by the time we were disbanded.
Did the officers in the squadron have a separate mess?
Yes, they did. There was another officer, apart from Major Nicol, of whom I've spoken, who was the second in command. One of those who was with us in the original volunteers was made into a second lieutenant, commissioned as a second lieutenant. So the time we came to be disbanded, we had, in fact, three officers.
And what was the relationship like between the officers and the troopers? Was it a formal relationship?
It had to be formal on parade, but off parade we lived separately. We were in our huts and they were in their place. And we didn't mix, no, we didn't mix socially at all.
What happened to you then after this announcement that you were to be disbanded?
Well, the general officer, whose name I seem to remember as Dickinson, said he could offer us sundry things. He could offer us to go into the King's African Rifles as the lowest rank in the King's African Rifle for a white man was at that time sergeant. He then said he was planning another unit which would be a sort of naval unit or enlargement of the existing minesweeper order they had. There were to be motorboats, and they would have a pile of sandbags up in the bows and a Vickers machine gun, and they would have a small crew armed. And they would be marauders and raiders, and they were to go up and down the coast, pillaging, harassing, trying to capture people and get information, rather as we had been. And then he offered us, he said he was expanding then a unit which was then called the East African Reconnaissance Squadron, who were a reconnaissance squadron mounted in motor vehicles, which were international box-body trucks, a sort of pickup truck, I think they're called now. In those days, referred to as box bodies. The driver and another man sat in the cab, and the back was like a small lorry, and there was a Bren gun mounted on the roof, and the gunner stood behind that and hoped that he didn't get shot between the legs. Well, those were the three things he offered us. So the person with whom I had joined as half section, I dissuaded him from thinking about this naval unit, because I said, here we have joined one adventurous unit and it has come to naught, And I somehow don't think that this other one will come to anything either. So I'm not going to apply for the naval unit. I shall not apply for the KAR. I shall apply for the East African Reconnaissance Squadron, which already had a renown for adventure. The war had started, and they had had some minor actions with the Italians, and they were of great prestige in East Africa, the East African Reconnaissance Squadron. It was said, in fact, at that time, that it was very hard to get into the East African Reconnaissance Squadron, even as a trooper, on 4 shillings a day. You had to be vetted by the sergeant's mess. It was a sort of elite. And in fact, the person with whom I had joined as half section into the Kenya Independence Squadron went off, I think, of his own initiative. He knew somebody who was in this squadron and went and ingratiated himself as best he could with them, so that when our names came up, we were accepted. So this Kenya Independence Squadron then broke up, really, into three groups. The Naval Marauders, the KAR, and the East African Reconnaissance Squadron. And we who were for that went away, a lorry load of us, with our kit and our camp beds and all this other stuff we had, to somewhere near Nanyuki, as far as I remember. I can't remember the place where they were based then. This was in the year 1940. Probably the month might have been September. I'm not sure at all. But it was well before Christmas, because I was in action with the East African Reconnaissance Squadron well before Christmas. Now, we then went off and became integrated into the East African Reconnaissance Squadron. They were then receiving armored cars. The armored cars were made in the Nairobi or Mombasa workshops of the East African Railways. They were made of boilerplate material. They had no turrets. They were a box, an iron box, boilerplate material, with a Chevrolet engine, something of that sort, a lorry engine, and a hole in the top through which the Bren gun, through which the car commander gunner poked his head out and fired the gun.
It's a sort of scout car, really.
I don't know what scout cars are like, but it was quite a large vehicle. There was room for three of us. There was a driver, and the general assistant and the car commander. The car commander fired the gun, so the third man was really to help the driver and help the car commander, to help the gun cleaning and maintenance of the vehicle. Well, we were then told that the name of the unit would be changed. It would no longer be the East African Reconnaissance Squadron. We were now to be the, first of all, it was to be called the East African Armored Regiment. It didn't remain that for long, and it was then called the East African Armored Car Regiment, because it was thought that there would be many regiments, and we were the first East African Armored Car Regiment. Well, this changing of titles didn't really affect anybody very much, except perhaps the postal authorities from England who wrote. But eventually, we settled down as the East African Armored Car Regiment. Later, very much later, the title was changed to the Kenya, or Kenya, as it is correctly pronounced in the vernacular, Armored Car Regiment, and that's what it remained known as, KACR. Before we were issued with these armored cars, I was with them with these trucks, and we were mostly patrolling between outposts where there were units of the King's African Rifles stationed. This was after the KAR had withdrawn from Moyale and other places. Then we got the cars issued. I was in A Squadron. The cars that we got were called Susies, because they were all given names. Susie and Sarah and Sasa Perilla, and I've even forgotten the name of mine. Anyway, the names were painted on the sides, like ships. and we were the Susie's type. So in A squadron. Sometime between when I was previously talking about and the end of the year, we pitched camp at a place called Arbo, as far as I remember, near Wajir, in the northern part of Kenya. And we were then in the more or less front line. And we had these, we lived in and around, each party lived in and around its car. We had slit trenches, we had night guards, all the things to ward off attack. We had lights out, no lights at night. And we were then attached to the Gold Coast Brigade, the Gold Coast Regiment. This is the West African Frontier Force Brigade. I can't remember all the details after this time of the names of the other units, but we were with the Gold Coast Brigade. And we accompanied them on an armed reconnaissance raid to, I think, it was a place called El Wak, where we gave the Italians a good fright. It was really a reconnaissance there in force. This armored car squadron went. We were in troops, of course.
How many cars would be in a troop?
Three. Three cars in a troop. I'm getting so rusty now. I think we were three cars in a troop, or was it three in a squadron? I'm really getting so rusty on this. I should have looked it up if I'd thought about it a bit. But there were three men in a car. So there were three cars in a troop. The troop leader's car had four men in, because it had a wireless operator. It had a driver, and then the odd man, and the car commander. And I think, I can't remember about this wireless operator now, to tell you the truth. This is in the first original cars. We went into battle. I was in two or three scraps. Luckily, the bullets didn't penetrate, but it was said that a good elephant gun could shoot through this boilerplate. Anyway, we had one or two little blitzes, I think is the best way to describe them, minor actions. But this other one at El Wak was the final one I remember, which was a great action with all the with these armored cars leading the way and with the Gold Coast Brigade along with us, a reconnaissance in force. And the Italians naturally withdrew then from El Wak. They didn't like it. We then returned and went on leave.
I'd like to ask you a bit more about this early use of armored cars. When you arrived at the recce squadron, what sort of training did they give you?
Very little, as far as I can remember. I knew how to drive a car. I now think was probably about September of 1940. And we were camped there. We had to spend quite a bit of time servicing our cars, making sure that they were running properly and well. And we were really waiting, as I didn't know at the time, for the armored cars to arrive. So the occasional patrols on which I drove out were to take some business that our unit may have had to one of the outposts where there may have been a platoon of the Gold Coast Regiment. And then I'd perhaps have to hang about and wait for an answer and come back again. Or we were just going round, keeping our eyes open, because looking for tracks, wheel tracks, anything that might not be our side but could be Italian, infiltrations. You couldn't really see very much from a vehicle driving along a dusty track in thornbush. But as far as I remember, at that time, that was what we were doing. Actual training, once your troop leader, who was an officer, and your troop sergeant were satisfied that you knew how to drive a car and were safe with it, there was no more training required in that. As far as I remember, we did some Bren gun training, probably, taking them to pieces, putting them together again, practicing. There was a thing called IA, which I think meant instant action. If the thing didn't work properly, there were certain things you could do to find out what was wrong. You had to know how to change a barrel quickly. We spent a lot of time doing that, arms training, you might say.
And shooting?
I don't remember shooting through a Bren gun at that stage at all.
But you were, at that time, you were a driver.
I was a driver. That was my position. But I could change with the others as required.
How did the box bodies handle?
The same as a small lorry. If you know how to drive a lorry, if you know how to drive a car, basically you can drive a lorry. It's a matter of getting used to the greater size. The box body pickup is really a small lorry. They were very good. They were made by the International Harvester Company, and I thought they were excellent vehicles. They had a nice high clearance underneath, and they were simple. There's no mechanical inclinations in my mind. I really never discovered properly how a car works and how to put it. But generally, among us in the car, crew of three, there was someone who knew, and I could listen for noises and say, I don't like that funny noise, what do you think it is? And perhaps I would then, while he was looking at that, I'd take my turn cleaning the gun, because these guns hadn't to be allowed to get covered with dust.
When you went on a patrol between outposts, how far apart would the outposts be?
Oh, I don't think, I don't think I ever went any long distances in those, my early days in that unit. When I say long distances, more than 5 or 10 miles, probably, if that much.
Did you ever see any evidence of infiltration?
No, I never saw anything.
At that time, can you remember if it was expected that the Italians might attempt another forward move?
I think it was half expected, insofar as it was known that the Italians wanted to get a boost to their morale. We had withdrawn from Moyale, as indeed in Western Europe we withdrew from other places because we hadn't got the means of holding it. It was thought, shall we say, rather than expected. It was the considerative opinion of a lot of people that the Italians could have been in Nairobi if they'd wished to in a very short space of time because they had masses of equipment. We didn't really discover how much equipment they had, I don't think, until we overran all their positions. But people thought, well, if the Italians got any go, why don't they come? We didn't want them to come because we weren't ready for them, I don't think. So when I say expected, I don't really believe that anyone had any real expectations. They hoped that they wouldn't come, but they thought it odd that they didn't. I think we might put it like that.
What did you make of the Gold Coast soldiers when you saw them? What impression did you get of them?
I thought they were fine fellows. They seemed to be well disciplined. We really hadn't much to do with any of them, because they had their role and we had ours. The contacts between the units, of course, are at higher level than that of the ordinary trooper who does what he's told. But I do remember one night taking our troop was sent to convey some Gold Coast Regiment night patrols out to their points and bring them back again. And it was dark, and they got probably 4 or 5 men into the back of each vehicle and their officer into the front. And his face was blackened because it wouldn't, if they met the enemy, the white face would obviously show up and the hands. Well, it was dark, we had no lights. This man got in and sat beside me and spoke to me, and I recognized him as a man whom I'd known on the colonial service course at Cambridge from his voice. I've forgotten his name now, but I drove him and his men out to wherever they had to go. They had to do a reconnaissance foot patrol, not necessarily for the purpose of engaging the enemy, because there were only a few, but to try and find out what they could, whether the enemy was probing towards us. That is one example I remember of these patrols. I've only remembered it since I started talking just now. And I've forgotten this man's name, but I remember his voice so well. And he was an administrative officer in the Gold Coast, as I was in the Assaland. And we had seen each other about a year previously, I suppose, or more than a year previously, at Cambridge University.
Were the outposts fortified?
No. not in the sense that there was. I think there may have been some barbed wire entanglements. As far as I remember, there were on the enemy side some coils of barbed wire, concertina wire, sort of stretched out a bit. But they must have had some elementary fortifications like that, but nothing very large. They were not, I mean, the whole time an advance was being planned from where we were. And in this bush country, presumably if the Italians had come along, rather than try and stand and stop them with totally inadequate forces, we would presumably have been withdrawn, because it's very easy to disappear in the African bush in the northern part of Kenya. But as I said before, being a trooper, I wasn't consulted or told any more than it was necessary for me to know for the efficient carrying out of my duties.
When you were driving around, what sort of speed did you normally maintain on a patrol?
Well, not very fast. I can't honestly remember, but I know you can never go very fast on these sandy bush roads. We may have gone up to 40 miles an hour. I can't remember, to tell you the truth.
How far ahead could you see normally going through a typical bit of country?
Well, if the road, down a straight road, you can see as far as you can on a straight road anywhere. Out to the sides, you couldn't see perhaps 20 or 30 yards where the bush was thick. In places where it was more open, of course, you could see as far as the vegetation allowed you to see.
Can you remember when the armoured cars from the Nairobi workshops arrived?
I believe they must have arrived, now that I've looked up a paper that I have here, about the beginning of October of 1940, when we were all fallen in and told that we were now to be converted into an armoured car regiment and to be called the East African, the first East African Armoured Regiment, as it was to be called to begin with. It was thought there would be many such regiments, and there would be a whole armoured division or brigade, first of all, and for East Africa.
How did the armoured cars compare in their handling characteristics with the box bodies?
Oh, they were very much heavier to drive. Very much. They were a heavy thing, those armoured cars. You didn't want to have a puncture with one of those if you could avoid it. All I remember was there was no problems. You engaged low gear when you were in rough ground and stayed in it. But I'm afraid I can't really remember far back enough. It's obvious that I got used to doing it and therefore it didn't present any hardship. But I remember later reading a book by Lawrence of Arabia about his men in the deserts, Arabian deserts, during the First War. How the drivers all became very muscular because of the weight of the wheel. And I know when I read that, not long after the war, I thought to myself, well, of course, yes, we must have put on a lot of muscle on our shoulders and forearms pulling those wheels apart.
What sort of speed could they do?
I dare say they could do 40 or 50 if you put them on a smooth tarmac road, but of course we never got the chance to try them out. I really don't know. I'm not a mechanically minded person. I don't understand mechanics. My mind somehow rejects the idea of mechanical things.
Were they stable?
Oh, yes. I never saw one lying on its side.
And I think the first time you were actually under fire was in the raid on El Wak in November 1940.
Yes, I'm sure that is correct.
What happened on that occasion?
On that occasion, I was the driver of a car of number 2 troop of A squadron. And of course I just drove where we had little slits which you could to see out of in the front and the side, and you could pull a screen, we might say, a small screen across those slits, which only had small holes drilled in, so it limited your vision. So you depended, once you were battened down there, you could only drive slowly because you had to know you were falling into a deep pit that had been dug for protection against armoured fighting vehicles. But we went along, and eventually I was in the troop leader's car, an officer in charge of the troop, and he, I seem to remember, said, head for that tree, head for this. He'd been briefed as to what to do, and off we went, and then I could hear the gun firing and shooting, and I was aware of bullets pinging on the vehicle, and I seem to remember I had a feeling of great exhilaration, because here was I in charge of a powerful vehicle pursuing the enemy, so to speak. I can't really remember much of my emotions, but I thought, well, I feel safe here. This is a good unit to have joined, or some thoughts like that may have gone through my mind. It didn't last very long. There were three cars of us there together, our troop, and I seem to remember now a sort of bush open clearing. I don't remember actually seeing any enemy, but I know we were being fired at, and I know we were firing. And at the end of circling and manoeuvring around a bit in this bush, in an open clearing, we didn't want to get into thick bush in this car, because then you could be booby-trapped. So we all stopped and had a rest, and everyone seemed very happy and pleased that we'd sent the enemy flying, and they were no longer there. That's really all that I can remember of it now.
Was that the occasion when you had to drive in the dark?
No, that was another time. From what I recollect, it could have well been. Yes, I think it was. I'm sorry, because the other time I wasn't in an armoured car. I was driving this armoured car. Yes, we got up early in the morning and we went along a long bush track, I remember. And the leading car could presumably see in the starlight of the early dawn, or find his way by recognising the line of the track. It was a definite track we drove along, we just didn't blunder through the bush. But of course, behind the car there was an enormous cloud of dust, each car. So a man sat at the back of the car with the door of the car open, which the entrance to the cars was from the back, with a lit cigarette in his mouth, and the driver of the succeeding car had to follow that cigarette end. It was quite trying, very exhausting. It didn't go very fast, luckily. But at times, the swirls of dust, it was difficult to see the cigarette end, I remember. And it was nice to spot him again.
So you're in a sort of single-line column.
Yes, we were. Yes, we were.
When you were actually in action, were you aware of the other cars in the troop being on either side of you, or...?
I think I was. I can't really remember very well, because after all, once we were in action, we had our little visors sort of down or closed, as it were, on the front and the side, and you really didn't see very much except straight ahead.
And you were just being told to go from one mark
yes,
to another?
Yes, more or less. We drove along, and the troop leader might have called out, turn left, go across there, or turn right across there. I really can't remember the details of that very well.
Did you see anything of any infantry, friendly infantry, on that raid?
Oh, not during the scrap. Afterwards we did. They were. I forget who they actually were, but we must have seen them. They probably stayed in the rear, waiting to see for us to brush the enemy out. And then they came in and went through and presumably looked for prisoners, if they could find any, and probing ahead a little bit, not too far. They didn't want to run into booby traps. These were only minor action. This was only a minor reconnaissance action, really, to find out what was what, and to clear up any small pockets of too confident enemy that we might find.
After this operation was over and you were back in your base, did you have a formal debrief?
No. What we had nothing. We just went back and...